Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hello, OCD family community. And welcome to part two of my OCRD series, where we are talking about emetophobia, or the fear of vomiting, with our special guest and fellow podcaster, Anna Christie, RCC and psychotherapist. So join us to learn and stick around for all the hope, because as Anna will share, recovery is possible when it comes to this highly treatable disorder.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Okay, fam. Welcome. Welcome to any newer family joining us. I'm so glad to have you. And I figure it likely bears repeating, but I'll just note, it has been an emotionally charged week here in the U.S. with a big election. But for folks that weren't with us last week, I will highlight again now that there are a lot of forums where people can go to process, grieve, celebrate, or anything in between from this election and more. I validate that there are a range of different feelings and emotions, but that is not my lane, because my lane, and thusly our lane, family, is talking about OCD and OC-related disorders, otherwise known as OCRDs. And there's not as much support or resources where loved ones and chosen family, lived experience warriors, and/or practitioners can go to learn more about how these disorders function, what's the right treatment, and all the hope that is available. So I very intentionally keep the content on message. I acknowledge that there will be things going on in our world, and I respect that since we've built some trust in this family community, sometimes there's a desire for me to speak more to certain issues and current events. So if that sentiment resonates with you, let me just say thank you for trusting me. And with that trust, I feel a responsibility to protect our conversations and time together for our warriors and loved ones. So if you're catching this episode hot off the press, just know I am deliberate in my reasoning and my focus. And so with that, as long as we are on the informed consent train, I'm going to go ahead and issue a trigger warning for any emetophobia warriors that may be joining. Emet, much like OCD more broadly, is idiosyncratic, which simply means as common and formulaic as its function can be, it affects each individual person in unique ways. So because fam with lived experience could be listening in from any particular part of their journey, there may be different sensitivities to our conversation herein. So we're going to be discussing the fear of throwing up or vomiting and using words as such. We will even describe some interventions that mimic sensations, and again, depending where folks are with their journeys, I just like to give that trigger warning. Overall, though, I promise that my aim in any given episode is to provide the greatest amount of access and hope available for all of our family. So I hope you can and will join us, because there's a lot of great information and a lot of encouraging hope, even in our amazing guest's story alone, as well as the practical tips for sufferers, loved ones, and practitioners alike. So let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, Anna Christie, so we can dive right in. Anna Christie has a history of OCD and emetophobia from which she has completely recovered. Based in Canada, she is now an author, podcaster, educator, researcher, and licensed psychotherapist specializing in emetophobia. Her podcast, Emetophobia Help with Anna Christie, has been a treasured resource in this field. And if you're on social media, you've likely seen Anna hanging around in all the spaces. Anna, I mean, it's so impressive. So while she'll talk a bit about her own story over the course of our time together today, I'll just highlight that her premiere episode of Emetophobia Help, so that would be season one, episode one, tells her story and is a really powerful example of the power and freedom of treatment. So I'll link that along with all the other incredible resources that we'll discuss over on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Okay, and with that, let's get to chatting because we've got lots to cover and I can't wait for you to hear more. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast today. What a pleasure. I'm telling you, I am sharing the airwaves here with a great resource, a great help, a great support, and a great warrior of her own right in the subject of emetophobia, and that is Anna Christie. RCC, that stands for Registered Clinical Counselor. That means she's a licensed psychotherapist that really knows her business here. So, Anna, I just want to say thank you for coming onto the show and hanging out with the fam.
Yeah, absolutely thrilled yes. to be here.
I think this is such an important topic to discuss because when we think of OCD and the related disorder category, there is somewhat of a special connection with emetophobia, which is why mm-hmm. I think it's important for it to be part of the broader conversation and learning and understanding. And so if you can help the family here understand a little more, what is emetophobia and how is it impacting the sufferer experiencing it?
Sure. Well, very simply, of course, emetophobia is the fear of vomiting. It's an extreme fear of vomiting. So to get a little nerdy, 6% of women, 1% of men fear vomiting. Okay, so that's 7% of the population. To give people an idea, in the United States, that would be 23-ish million people. But only about 0.2% will actually seek help for their fear of vomiting. So we're thinking that emetophobia affects, you know, there are lots of people that won't seek help, of course, because mm-hmm. they're too afraid to seek help. So at least 0.2%. So they may be afraid of vomiting themselves. That's the most common type. Or they may be afraid of seeing or hearing or being around someone else who is vomiting. And usually it's both things, but sometimes only one of those things. There is a common virus called norovirus, which is often misnamed and called stomach flu. It's not a flu, but it's called stomach flu, stomach bug, tummy bug. There's all kinds of names for it, but it's actually norovirus. And it causes, as you probably know, 24-hour nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. So
yeah,
the people that I work with, people with emetophobia, are terrified of catching that. So a lot of their behavior and their avoidance comes from the fear of catching norovirus. They're not afraid of getting a cold or getting influenza or whatever, but yeah. they're really scared of that. So yeah, it's a really debilitating phobia as well. So if you're really scared of vomiting, you may not eat. I mean, I've worked with parents with children that had to be hospitalized because they stopped eating altogether. You may not socialize because there's alcohol around and stuff and people get drunk. Mm-hmm. You may not be able to sleep. You may not want to go outside because you might catch something or see someone. So you can become agoraphobic, even though that would just not be the primary diagnosis.
But yeah.
Yeah, I can go on for the whole hour.
And a distinction that I want to make sure listeners understand is nobody really enjoys vomiting, right? And so sometimes when we describe this fear, it can feel like a deathly fear. The intensity can feel like an 11 out of a 10, right? It's different than I don't like vomiting. I don't enjoy it. There is a piece to that feeling out of control, but not so much of the mainstream thought of, oh, I'm vomiting and it's hard to breathe. It's like next level. Actually, it's a couple floors up from the next level, right?
Yeah, nobody signs up for it, I don't think. But unfortunately, people sometimes actual professionals. Someone says they have emetophobia, it's an extreme fear of vomiting, and they get met with the response, someone will say, well, nobody likes it.
Right.
And I never know what to do with that particular comeback. It's like, okay,
yeah.
Like, what's your point? Yes, yeah. True. And it's like, nobody likes spiders. Nobody likes falling off a ladder and, you know, all kinds of things, but our lives are not changed. So I think that's the distinction. My life is no different because I don't like spiders, or I get kind of nervous all the way up a ladder to the roof, but I still will go up there if I have to. So it's not about just not liking it,
yeah,
or even just being kind of afraid. I met one of the 7% of people one time, and he told me, he goes, I'm afraid. I'm really afraid of it. I cry if I have to vomit. But he doesn't think about that except once every 10 or 20 years when he's actually sick.
Yeah.
Whereas people with emetophobia think about it every waking moment.
Yeah.
It's on their mind and it just consumes their lives and it stops them from enjoying life and even living life sometimes.
Yeah. And we're going into a time of year where in this area of the world, we're going into that colder fall weather toward winter with even more cold. There's going to be less outdoor activities, more people inside. And so it is part of that season, cold and flu season, where there is typically an uptick in the amount of anxiety about threat for a lot of people with emetophobia. So a lot of people will describe, I can feel scared always, but you add on the layer of going into something like cold and flu season, and it feels especially terrifying.
It does. Yeah. You know, and they talk about how they hate winter. And I get many more requests for help around October. Just starts around October. And my inbox will fill up with people looking for help in one way or another because the winter, you know, as soon as the kids are back at school,
Right.
Yeah.
Kids, little germ magnets. I have three little germ magnets of my own, so I know. Yeah.
We've got two grandchildren that live with us with their parents. So yeah, they bring home pretty much everything.
Yes.
But that's just how it is. Yeah.
That is how it is. And so it's one of the reasons, not only after having children, but even the process for women, for example, getting pregnant, it can be a trigger and sometimes something that's avoided because of the pervasive level, the intrusive nature of the fear that they may be struggling with morning sickness, which it's a misnomer. In case anybody here in 2024 doesn't realize it, it doesn't mean it's just in the morning. It can be any time of the day. And it's just that impending threat, the uncertainty about if and when it could show up. It's really, really adding a lot of distress to the level that when we look at some of these disorders and we look at emetophobia, a disorder means it's getting to the point where it's interfering with your ability to function in life as you would otherwise if it wasn't there. So in your home relationship, your social relationships, work relationships, school relationships. So it really is so much bigger than I don't like throwing up.
Also, right.
And it's hard for family members to understand sometimes because for so many, and I'm going to guess yourself included, Anna, that you've thrown up before in your life. And
yes.
A lot of people will say, you lived through it. It's not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. And again, nobody likes it. And it does feel like that very minimizing response. But it is the brain. And as we talk about in a lot of different areas, whether we're talking about OCD or any of these OCD-related disorders, the brain is braining. So just because you survive something doesn't mean it's not feeling like the utmost threat, dire, urgent, life or death situation. For a lot of people, I'm thinking of a client even in particular, for a lot of people, it's that fear of, I might get that feeling that will never go away. Sometimes it doesn't even, you know, go to a worst case scenario more than this distress ick feeling I have, like, I can't sit here in this space. And so emetophobia is a real issue. As you said, it's a significant portion of the population. When you really look at it, yes, we have billions of people on the earth, but we're talking about millions of people that struggle with this. And so this is such an important topic. Now, what we don't understand, which for a lot of these different mental health disorders, other than the fact that we have brains and brains experience different things, what causes emetophobia? I know that there is not, it's not going to be like a satiating answer for you, fam, in terms of what causes it, because wouldn't we all love to know the exact reasons why? But what are some of the underlying contributors that we are learning likely have an impact to varying degrees?
Sure. First of all, I think when you talk about, is it nature or nurture, it's probably 50-50, like a lot of things. So probably 50% of it is a genetic predisposition to having anxiety, which could be people in your family with depression, addiction, not necessarily anxiety, but somewhere back there, there's, you know, probably, or maybe you just describe your mom or your dad as a worrier. They're worried. Well, in fact, on the inside, they're extremely anxious. So that's about half of it. The rest of it seems like a perfect storm of factors. A lot of people think, oh, you must have had a terrible incident.
Traumatic event. Yeah.
Something happened in your past with vomiting. Whatever. I won't even describe it, but not necessarily. I mean, I've worked with lots of people who cannot pinpoint anything in their memory, at least. So something could have happened before they were 5 years old that they don't really remember, but their body remembers it.
Yeah.
You know, so because maybe you were sick and you were crying and somebody didn't come pick you up out of the crib immediately, or nothing awful. I tell my clients, so it's not like your parents put you in a dog crate in the basement and didn't feed you, you know, like,
right.
It could be that, like, if they did that, then that's definitely trauma related stuff. But if you think about, you know, say a kid develops a fear of dogs, well, there are enough dogs around, neighbors have dogs, there's dogs up and down the street. Eventually you come to realize dogs aren't really dangerous for the most part. And you get over your fear of dogs. But vomiting is something you don't do very often. And so the times in between vomiting incidents for a child is just an escalation of anticipatory anxiety. So the waiting kind of anxiety when nothing's happening, but you're imagining that it's catastrophic and awful. And that can go on for years, along with the fact that we can't really say, you know, we can work with someone with a fear of dogs, and in two or three sessions, we can get them to give a dog a bath or pet a dog. But it's not like that with emetophobia. We can't set it up in such a way that it just automatically gets people over it quickly. So one of the things I have found in my work, I was first trained in family systems, and I usually do a family history and do a genogram with people. And you know, sometimes pretty close, I find that maybe something happened in the attachment between primary caregiver, usually mother, and child. And it doesn't have to be, like I said, bad. Like one child had emetophobia because two times when her brother and sister were born, her mom was in the hospital having babies, and she got the norovirus, stomach flu, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And mom wasn't there and dad wasn't there, you know, so this is a lovely family, nothing wrong with them at all. But sometimes mom goes back to work, nothing wrong with that. Sometimes there's a divorce, you can't help that. But these are things that can add to the stress that is part of that perfect storm of factors that contribute to emetophobia.
You know, it reminds me a little bit of like autoimmune diseases in terms of if we have a gene or we have kind of that neurocircuitry where we have the potential for something happening, a stressful event, which is somewhat subjective, what's stressful for me might not be as stressful for someone else. And it doesn't have to be this big catastrophic event, as you described, can activate, can kind of switch on. In the terms of the autoimmune disease, there's more to it. I'm not a doctor, y'all, so talk with someone much more knowledgeable about that than me. But it is interesting how I think often people are trying to grapple with where or why did this start? And I think that's an understandable part of our process whenever we're dealing with something difficult to go, is there a root to this? Could have it been prevented? Might have it happened, if not this, but that over here? Was I destined to be stuck here? And so I think in part, it's that grappling of trying to understand. But also what we're going to be talking about today is that there is actually a lot of hope, even if you're dealing with this intense fear that absolutely can impact your functioning. There's so much hope available and there are treatments available. There's so much we're going to cover during this time. So I'm so grateful that we can have this conversation. And in understanding emetophobia in terms of strategies, when to seek help, what would you say to somebody maybe listening or knowing somebody in their family that may be struggling with this? At what point do you determine, you know what, I need to try and find somebody to help me be able to manage through this? And again, recognizing that's tough to do, especially this time of year when people are more likely to want to stay put, not engage, not want to go to a doctor's office or a crowded place. Mm-hmm. So what would you say to that?
The time to seek help for anything, I think, is when whatever it is that you have is impacting your life in a negative way. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get pregnant, but you can't because you're afraid of morning sickness, then you need help. If you can't eat, if you can't go and socialize with your friends, if you can't work, if you can't go out of the house, if it's impacting your relationship because you're always fighting with your partner about how clean or sanitized everything is that they touch, or they have to behave a certain way, you're starting to control other people, especially your kids, but it can disrupt and break up relationships as well. So if it affects any of those areas, they used to be called axes. And they were like, imagine a wheel and spokes on a wheel.
Yeah.
A little pizza pie slices, you know, and there are different parts. There's work and play and relationships and all that stuff. So it can affect something on every axis. Every piece of the pizza can be affected. But I think personally, if it's affecting any one of those things, it's probably would be a good idea to try and get some help.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, I love hearing your perspective on that. And I agree. I think what is enough to warrant support relief? I mean, it doesn't even have to be. I'm a big proponent of this and I'll say it a lot. And so me and my clients listening will be like, oh, she says this a lot. But it doesn't have to be like the house is on fire to get help. It can be, it's hot and I'm uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And perhaps because of how the medical model is structured, but there's somewhat of this framework of once it passed this threshold, now this is a problem. And so you should seek help for this problem. Problems are kind of subjective in terms of how they're impacting us, the level of distress they're bringing upon us, which is okay. We're all individuals. We're going to experience things differently. And so if you're like, you know what? I don't go to holiday parties. I can't have the kids have friends over. Mm-hmm. I am afraid of getting pregnant. I am afraid of going to the grocery store. I'm afraid of gas stations and the nozzles on gas stations or, you know, whatever the situation is, to the point that you can't do it, to the point that it's occupying your thoughts, even if you do kind of muscle through it, then support is available. Support's available before it even gets to that extreme, but support is available. And so what we're going to describe in the process today is what does it look like to be able to treat emetophobia? How do we work with this? And really, how do we facilitate and foster hope for people that may have lived with this most of their lives or as long as they can remember? And they're going, I need it to be better than this. I need that.
Yeah. Yeah. Treatment, you know, if you really are at the point in your life where you want and need and can afford treatment. Now, I know that insurance works differently in the United States. In fact, for mental health, it's actually better, I think, than it is in Canada, because you have to have extra insurance on top of our free healthcare. Our free healthcare here is only for physical ailments, not mental health. So if you want to see someone and have insurance pay for it, you need to get what's called extended health insurance. Anyway, so let's just say you can afford it one way or another, then you would be looking for someone who preferably understands emetophobia, knows what it is, understands it, can diagnose it, and knows how to treat it. And that would be someone who offers cognitive behavioral therapy, which is CBT, with exposure and response prevention, ERP. So probably you've talked about this a lot on your podcast, but cognitive behavioral therapy without the exposure part is really only cognitive therapy. And cognitive therapy is very helpful, learning to think differently about vomiting and whatnot. But it's very helpful, but it won't fix it. It won't lead you into recovery from it without the exposure. Some people online, you're always going to find somebody online. I did hypnosis and that worked, and I did a Thrive program or something and that worked. Well,
brain
good, but there's no, anything, tapping and all kinds of stuff, but there's no science behind it. So the only evidence-based technique is CBT with exposure response prevention. As soon as you say that, however, to someone with emetophobia, they often get the wrong idea about what exposure is, and they believe, oh, they're going to make me vomit or they're going to vomit in front of me. And that is not true. We don't make anybody vomit. If you have a therapist that says, well, you just have to vomit and then you'll get over it or something. Well, no, you don't have to be bitten by a dog or go back to the war to get over your PTSD. I don't make people sick. It goes against the very beginning premise of a Hippocratic oath, which all caregivers should really adhere to, do no harm. So we don't harm people anyway. But we very slowly and gradually expose people to things like words that mean vomit and sentences and stories and your imagination and maybe some drawings and then some pictures of people that look nauseous and so on, very, very slowly through to sounds and videos and then doing interoceptive work and so on, along with cognitive work of thinking differently about it.
Yeah.
So that's what you do. Mm-hmm. If you cannot afford it, there weren't too many avenues for you. And now there are some good books on the market, self-help books, which can be helpful. It's hard to go through something as serious as this and get better just from a book. I'm sure it's true with OCD as well. There are lots of books on OCD.
Right.
There are only two or three for emetophobia.
One of which being Anna's, y'all.
My book that's out is actually for clinicians. It's not even for people suffering with emetophobia. Not a self-help.
Right.
I've actually got a contract to write a self-help book, but that won't be out for a couple of years. But so, yeah, there's one called The Emetophobia Manual. There's one called Free Yourself from Emetophobia by Drs. Veal and Keyes. Ken Goodman wrote The Emetophobia Manual. A lot of people like that. And there's one called Dara Lovett's David Yusko Gag Reflections. That's it. Those are the three that are out. Our book is for clinicians, how to treat it. People with emetophobia seem to like reading my book as well. So maybe, you can read it and then give it to your therapist or something. So.
Yeah. But, for a lot of people, and we're going to talk about how core psychoeducation is to part of this treatment. And it's not to say it's impossible. I will say I came into the OCD field going, I need to learn OCD, because I had a client that was presenting with, as I tongue-in-cheek joke, they were presenting with OCD symptoms that were so loud, even I couldn't miss them. Because I realized once I learned that I was like, oh, I've missed this a lot. And so it's not to say that your clinician can't learn along with you or lead the way and kind of dive in and learn. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us have a heart to, we meet a client, we see a situation that's painful, and we see a path, especially an evidence-based path towards hope and healing. And we're like, I want to be a part of that. But also, it's totally fair if you're like, I'm coming in to learn how to not feel so crippled by this. I don't have the time or the money or the interest to try and teach you for you to learn, right? Uh-huh. And so you can pass on the book. And I think that's a great plan. But also, if you're like, I am tired, I am scared, I am struggling, it's okay too to test out a therapist and say, do you know what this is? And if they're like, I don't, or if they are just kind of saying, now you're going to practice throwing up today, then you can go, see ya.
I run so fast. I do have a therapist list on my website at emetophobiahelp.org. And if you're a therapist listening and you treat emetophobia with evidence-based practices, then please drop me an email. I'm sure it'll be in the show notes, and I will put you on my list. There are some states in the United States and some countries in the world that I do not have people there yet that I could refer to. So that list is, it's not a very long list. And I know there are 10 times that many people treating this. So
Yeah. I mean, we find similarly in the OCD field, and I would say there's definitely more OCD treatment specialists and emetophobia specialists. And yet there are so many people that don't know, and they don't realize they've been working with clients that are suffering from OCD, and they just have missed it. So yeah, I think that is a really great point. If you are listening, if you are treating, please reach out to Anna. And like she said, she has a ton of amazing resources for people with lived experience as well as clinicians. And so I'm going to be linking all of that on this episode's blog over at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. So you definitely want to check that out. But yeah, the psychoeducation around what's happening with emetophobia is huge. And like you said, the thought work alone isn't going to solve it. But also, I like that you emphasize that also the exposure paired with some of the thought processes around this, and that is CBT, basic CBT. If you picture a triangle, it's that connection between the thoughts and the feelings and the behaviors. So we have to recognize that in that circuit, more or less, that doing something to one part can affect all parts, but all parts are included in that circuit. And so you're describing exposure. You're describing interoceptive exposure. Let's take a minute, if we can, and just describe what we mean. I'm big into interoceptive and invisible exposures, but just for anybody new joining us, can you tell us a little bit more by what you mean by that?
Well, let's, if I can start with in vivo, which means in real life. So if you came to me for your emetophobia, there would be words and sentences and pictures and videos and things that I would show you in our sessions together. And I would track how high your anxiety goes when you see them and so on. And we would talk about, can you tolerate that amount of anxiety without doing anything at all to try to lower it or calm down? Can you just sit with that number? So that's what I would be doing. So that's sort of virtual exposure, virtual reality, you know, on my computer. Then in vivo, in real life, I have folks, I have a checklist, a long checklist of safety behaviors that people do when they have emetophobia. So they clean, or they might sip water because they're nauseous. They might take peppermints or ginger or tea or all sorts of things. So big, long list. And then they'll have another list of things they avoid. I avoid going to jungle gyms with my kids. I avoid all kinds of this. So I have them put those things in order of easiest to give up all the way to the hardest to give up, which is normally a hierarchy of fears.
Right.
Although there's sort of a separate hierarchy on a website I share with David Russ at emetophobia.net. That's a hierarchy in and of itself, but they have this in vivo hierarchy. And so they just work away one thing at a time. I let them know you got to give all that stuff up, because if you want to be normal, you got to act normal. So the normal being, you know, a funny word, but I mean by it, someone without emetophobia, if you want to be like that, you got to behave like people who don't have it. And they don't take ginger tea every time they feel a little something in their stomach. So that's the in vivo work. After we do most of the other exposure, we do something called interoceptive. And often when clients hear about this, they freak out and don't want to start anything from the beginning. So talk amongst yourselves and follow like your therapist.
They're like, I was worried when you said exposure. Now you're saying interoceptive. Yeah, I don't know
interoceptive.
What to do.
It's, you know, you got to look at it like you're down in a hole and you can't get out. There's light at the top, but there's a ladder. So you can go rung by rung. When you're at the bottom, the top looks impossible. But if you go rung by rung, it's not so bad. So interoceptive means doing things that actually make you feel nauseous, not purposely throwing up, because that's hard to do, actually.
Right.
And people with emetophobia are people who don't vomit very often. We don't even know how that's related But there are things like maybe spin around and make yourself dizzy, because people are always terrified of feeling dizzy. Or maybe you can order stuff online that smells like vomit. You can order things online that look like vomit, you know, joke shop vomit. You can put oatmeal in your mouth and pretend to throw up in a toilet. We can do all kinds of stuff,
yes,
but it's all body involved. So interoceptive means involved with your body.
Yeah. The level of people going, what? Why?
Right. Yeah.
So let's explain some of the secret sauce when it comes to exposure and response prevention. Exposure therapy has long, long been one of the main evidence-based treatments for anxiety disorders. And that's because we've learned, you described how sometimes this anxiety can be building for years or decades, and then a trigger can present itself. And all that anxiety, if you imagine a hill of anxiety climbing, what we've learned traditionally when treating anxiety disorders is if we get kind of rescued, if we do have that safety behavior come in and swoop in, what our brain learns is not that the threat wasn't so bad or even a real threat. Sometimes it's just the sensation and there's actually no threat. How many of us have ever felt nauseous or had any kind of GI distress outside of vomiting and we never vomited, right?
Right.
So it's not a perfect, like, if I have some indigestion, if I have some mouth watering, this for sure means that I'm going to throw up. But because it is such an intense fear, then we have this anxiety climbing up. And what we've learned through traditional exposure therapy is that if you can stick with the feared event, then your brain will learn at a certain point, you know what? This threat was a lot of talk, was a lot of bark, not biting. And it will start to, whether it's habituate or there's different kind of backgrounds, inhibitory learning to exposure, et cetera. When we talk about ERP, and we talk about this in the OCD world as well, so return fans gonna be like, yes, we know it. We know it. It's exposure and response prevention, literally preventing a response. So if you think my response is usually the ginger tea and the mints and avoiding the grocery store, and then we wipe everything down with a Clorox wipe or some kind of neutralizing agent. For some people, it might be avoiding the neutralizing agents because maybe that smell could trigger something. It could be a number of different scenarios.
Right.
Then we're practicing that response prevention. Why? Because what we're learning is just exposure in and of itself isn't going to fix it. Because part of what is happening is our brain has learned this pattern, this system of, if you don't have the ginger tea, you're going to be screwed. If you do go to the play park in the mall, oh my goodness, play parks in the mall. Do go out during norovirus outbreak. You saw something circulating on Facebook or however news is kind of circulating in your community.
Yeah.
And so it's that response prevention that helps the brain learn, even in absence of the safety behavior, my brain can learn to not only tolerate the distress, tolerate the threat, ultimately the anxiety in and of itself isn't going to hurt me, and just go ahead and move forward, live my life, and my brain will catch up to just moving on and through it. And so that's part of what's going on in ERP. So if you're going like, why in the world would I ever put oatmeal in my mouth, pretend to be throwing it up, like that, I would never do that. And when you're talking about putting yourself in that exposure, which is not where you start, people, you're not going to start.
No.
That's like
it's like the almost the top rung of the ladder. Yeah.
Like you're about to be on the roof. You
there's 100 rungs before that.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Then you're learning, I can be in these scenarios and going through these different experiences, and I can prevent the response, and my brain can learn something different here. And so ERP, to people that are new to learning about it, are like, what? But also part of the magic of people that have done ERP and have felt the freedom that can come from the brain learning a new response is as scary as it sounds on this side of it, to be on the other side of it and go, actually, I can go live my life. And if dad is having his birthday, and I don't know how many birthdays we'll have left with dad, and it's right there in November, and there was some cold outbreak going in the community, I can still go and have these value-driven times and not be prevented by that fear in and of itself, which is so powerful.
Yeah. I was just making a note here to just to emphasize one of the things you just said about value-driven times, you know, which is, to me, it comes out of a second generation of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is ACT, mm-hmm. acceptance and commitment therapy. And the acceptance part is when I say to people, okay, you're at 6 out of 10 looking at this picture. Can you accept that? Can you just accept it or tolerate is another word. And you just leave it alone. Just leave that anxiety there at that number. Because eventually, as you said, the part of the brain that's giving you the trouble sort of says to itself, well, she's not doing anything. She's just sitting there. So I guess it's not dangerous.
Yeah.
And that's the learning. That's that inhibitory learning that we want. That's what you want. And the value-driven stuff is a lot of therapists will say, can you sit with the anxiety? And people think you need to literally just sit there feeling anxious. No, you need to get on with whatever it was you would have been doing if you weren't having a panic attack. Or what is cooking? Is it your work? Is it playing with your kids? Is it, you know, whatever it is that you value, that you want, the way you want to live your life. That's what you should be doing, and just leave the anxiety alone and it will go away. But caveat with all of that I just said, you do have to do this gradually,
yeah.
Especially with emetophobia. I think there are other phobias that you could be a little more shocking, specific phobias sometimes. You know, a clown can come in the room if you're really scared of them. Although it'd be better to look at pictures of clowns first, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, you need to do this gradually so that you are tolerating anxiety at lower numbers with easier things, easier rungs on the ladder, so that when you get up to the higher rungs, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
If you already know you can do it.
Yeah. I think something I hear, whether it's in OCD therapy or some of these OCRDs, is that the things that feel debilitating in my life are up here. They are those higher rungs. That's what I need. And so sometimes there's people that may even struggle. They're either like, I don't want to do exposure, or they're like, well, I want to get this stuff up here. But the reason, again, part of the reason why we're going incrementally is we can't eat the whole animal at once. We got to take a bite at a time. And we don't lose you in that process.
Right.
Because yeah. You've been facing the big animal all your life. You survived mm-hmm. up to this point facing the big animal. The animal is still there, scary and terrible. So we got to find a different mm-hmm. way to approach living the life that you want while not engaging in mm-hmm. whether it's the safety behaviors or not engaging in the story that gets created around what big, bad, terrible something will happen. But like you said, if it's going to a kid's birthday party, then instead of engaging in that, and not mm-hmm. for the purpose of distracting ourselves from that, but to go live your life, you're going, mm-hmm. okay, I'm aware it's here, but I'm choosing to not give it my attention. I'm choosing to not engage with it. That's
right.
Part of the difference mm-hmm. there.
Mm-hmm.
And so can we talk a little bit about, I was just talking with a client about this really, really recently, which I'm sure you're listening, but I was talking with them about the difference between engagement and distraction and
right.
awareness. And so what can you say to help people understand some of the nuances there?
Yeah, it is a thin line. And difficult to differentiate. So if you're thinking that, you're not the only one. The way I describe it is I've had clients who would be maybe doing an exposure and then all of a sudden they grab their phone and they're like, I have to play a game, you know, to distract myself. I have to do this thing. And you anxiously grab onto some distraction. I have to put my music on. I have to hear this song, you know. Well, if it's I have to and it's a panic to do it, and that's a distraction. You're using distraction. Or, oh, if I just go and, you know, watch this TV show, I'll be distracted and I'll forget about my anxiety. Well, that might be true, but don't forget that the part of your brain that I'm saying is talking now is going to say, oh, good thing she watched that TV show or we would have died. You know, because this part of the brain we often call the reptilian brain. So it's dumb, like an alligator, like it's not the smart part of your brain. It's just very, very survival driven. So it's responsible for your survival. So it'll do anything to help you survive. And If it thinks that vomiting is going to kill you, then it's going to go to great lengths to convince you of that, when in fact, it's impossible to die from vomiting unless you are unconscious, completely unconscious and lying on your back. Then you can die. So what are the odds of that? Zero if you have emetophobia.
Right.
Because you won't be unconscious for any reason. You won't be, won't be drunk or on drugs or whatever.
Right. Which is the most common situation, I was going to say, with like ODing or something to that effect. And what most.
Yeah, exactly.
And most people with emetophobia ultimately hate that feeling of being out of control. And so a lot of people with emetophobia are going to be less likely to want to engage with substances where they feel altered in any way,
right,
because they don't want to feel altered. It's unpredictable. Mm-hmm. And when it's unpredictable, you might vomit, or you might get sick. You might get exposed to something. And so it is such a great point that while the brain can kind of gaslight you and say, and I know gaslight gets brief, but this is happening, you know, your perception of reality isn't really what it's going to be. And no matter how much everybody else tells you, hey, it's not going to go down that way, your brain's like, but it could and it might. And if you didn't do that, you probably would have, right? Mm-hmm. And so it really is fighting some of these different safety behaviors, the compulsion or the urge, which is where we see that relationship to OCD. There is that strong urge, and it feels like the consequences are very dire if you don't use those safety behaviors. And so it's part of the reason why it's gotten attached and grouped with OCD. But you can have emetophobia and not have OCD.
Yeah, you raise an interesting point. If I can talk about OCD for a moment,
please,
like on your OCD podcast.
Yes.
Emetophobia is somehow connected to OCD. So it's actually not true that you can have emetophobia and not have OCD. Oh. At least we've never seen that.
Never seen
someone with emetophobia without OCD. And I'm not just talking about hand washing because of the norovirus or whatever. What I started doing, I started teaching classes just to give people an opportunity to work with me for 10 hours without paying as much. So I get 10 people in a class, so a lot more people. And for the past couple of years, I've been giving everybody the Y-Box OCD inventory, which is a questionnaire that you can theoretically diagnose OCD. And no one who has taken that has not scored at a moderate or higher rate, like 16 and above on this Y-Box. So there was one study done by Dr. David Veal, who's the primary researcher and has been into emetophobia. And he and his colleagues looked at OCD and emetophobia and concluded that emetophobia might indeed be a subset of OCD, a type of OCD. Mm-hmm. However, unlike OCD, there has not been hardly any research into emetophobia. When I say hardly any, I actually list every research article at the back of our book, and there are only about 85 studies ever done. Like if you go to a library, type in OCD journal articles, you're going to get thousands of them, thousands. Mm-hmm. But 85. I think there was another one just done, actually. So 86 now. Not very much research, but somehow it's related to OCD. Yeah. And people have rituals and they count things. They're checking things constantly, or they're having obsessive thoughts they just can't get rid of. Even if they leave them alone or whatever it is, they've got this continual obsessive thought and compulsive behaviors as well. So anyway, that's my little blurb about OCD and wishing that we had more research funding and to do more.
Yeah. So if anybody listening or any graduate students that are looking for a dissert project or
call
interested.
Me. Yeah. I have data. I've got lots of data you can have.
And she's super warm and responsive, y'all. I was telling Anna before the show, I was like, you know, I'm going to shoot my shot and see if I can touch base. But, you know, I know that you are doing so much great work and you're so busy, I'm sure, with all of that. But she was very, very willing to come. And as we talked about just in our greetings to each other, the desire to build more awareness, because this is like the psychoeducation campaign starts here, where we go, we need to have some conversations, dispel some myths, help create understanding around what this means. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, there was a trigger warning because for some folks listening to this podcast would be higher up on that ladder because we're talking about FOMA, we're talking about different aspects of it. And so we may have some family or some loved ones, some spouses going, yeah, I would love for my person to listen to this, but I think they could shut down hearing even this conversation. So where do we start there? Well, it sounds like a really good place to start. And like you said, Anna, if you can afford it or manage it, is finding a therapist, a cognitive behavioral therapist. I will say, even if emetophobia is a subset of OCD, not every OCD therapist gets it.
No, but if you're stuck, like in the sense that there's no one in your area, you want to see someone face to face, the best therapist to go to, if nobody's heard of emetophobia, the best therapist to go to is someone who knows how to treat OCD.
OCD, yes.
Because they will treat it with ERP and you can talk with them a few times and they'll probably get it.
Yeah.
Easier than going to just randomly trying to find a therapist.
Fair. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I would agree with that as well, too. The nature of the beast on how this functions. And that's a big kind of buzzword for cognitive behavioral therapists, but particularly with OCD specialists, is you need to look at that function. Another core piece to the ERP, too, is identifying what your core fear or fears are underlying what's happening for you. And so that that's really, too, looking at that cognitive piece and going, okay, am I afraid of dying? Am I afraid of just always feeling this way? Am I afraid that I'm going to lose control and not be able to regain it? Could I lose control and that could bring harm to somebody else in my vicinity if I'm driving and I'm vomiting and the situation be?
Yeah.
And so I find, too, and would love to hear your thoughts on this, that a lot of people, it's not uncommon, people that I've had come into my office have first experienced at least one or more panic attacks, not always, but sometimes by the time they're getting to treatment. The ERs, the emergency rooms could probably use some good training around what this is, because I'm sure they see a fair amount of folks coming in. But a lot of times people might come in and they might go, well, I think I might have this panic disorder or I'm afraid of going out. Maybe it is something like agoraphobia, which would be that fear of going into circumstances where you may not be able to feel like you can escape or be in control. And that can lead to being afraid of leaving your home or a certain space. And so in terms of looking at those pieces, too, especially if folks have been dealing with panic attacks more, around this, if we look at the root, the core fear is I could throw up. And that's kind of what's underlying it. What would you say to folks that are escalating to that point? Maybe they've experienced it, or just, you know, even providing some hope that it doesn't have to always be this way for them. You know, what would you say?
Well, first of all, but I used to have emetophobia and it was very serious. And I got down to like 85 pounds and I only ate bananas and digestive cookies when I was 17 years old and living away from home. And so, that was the 70s, folks. And there was no internet and there was nobody. And I wouldn't tell anyone that I had it because I was afraid I'd be locked up for life, like literally afraid of that. So as I clawed my way back into how I am now, which is not the least bit afraid of it, I can say to other people, I don't think you probably could have had it worse than I did. Like, I really haven't met anybody. I've met people with all kinds of different manifestations of this phobia, and no two are alike. No one's exactly like me, but it is a highly treatable phobia, and people do recover from it and live normal lives all the time. And if you're looking online, Facebook groups or whatever, those are not the people that, God bless them all, that are there for support and whatnot. But when someone recovers from emetophobia with a good therapist and they go on to live their lives, they don't generally go back onto Facebook groups and hang out there with, I mean, I do because I'm always hanging out everywhere online. I'm everywhere online, people.
I'm on TikTok now.
So I'm everywhere. Yeah. But, you know, it's highly treatable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of people recover.
Yeah. It's such a great point. What I will say, too, is anybody that I've ever had the honor working with that has struggled with emetophobia. And of course, for Return Fam, you may remember my mother-in-law was on the show talking about her experience of emetophobia. It is such a struggle too, because these people are super attuned to their internal cueing. And this is part of why interoceptive exposure becomes an important part of the process, because they're going to scan without realizing they're scanning even for any possible threat. And it becomes, for a lot of people, not even just about vomiting, because what if I feel like I'm going to have diarrhea or I'm bloated? Mm-hmm. That could be a signal that now is related to this, could be related to this, could be related to that. And so it's interesting, because following the publishing of this podcast during our OCRD series, I'm having a conversation about anxiety sensitivity with another guest. And I see that show up not only in emetophobia, we see it in other areas of OCD, we see it in other disorders for sure. You can have it without being in a disorder. But the attention to our physiological cues, such a zoomed in look and such a zoomed in perspective, would be challenging for anyone. And so a lot of people with lived experience, it's going to be this process, again, of not choosing to put a spotlight and focus on or scan for these different physiological symptoms that in the past have equated high threat level for emetophobia. And again, it's part of the reason why that gradual exposure and response prevention is going to be such a key piece, but also looking at the cognitions that go with that, the story that gets created around that of what will happen, what will the meaning of this be if I go to the mall and my kid touched a wrapper on the floor or whatever the thing is.
Right.
So it's complex, but like you said, there is a lot of hope available. And so I am going to be linking. We have emetophobiahelp.org, which is an amazing resource. You guys check it out. Also, for therapists, for practitioners, you co-wrote a book for clinicians to understand how to do this therapy. But in addition to that, you have emetophobia.net, where you have resources. And you have a couple different measures. You do have the Y-Box, which we are familiar with the Yale-Brown Obsessive Compulsive Scale here. Yeah. But also there's some different measures that you recommend can be useful.
Emetophobia.net is where therapists, for clinicians who want to treat emetophobia or understand it. It's completely free. You don't even have to put your email in. There's no ads on the site, nothing. And I built it together with my writing partner, Dr. David Russ, child psychologist. And so he's got a whole section for children and adolescents if you're treating, but a great section for kids. And then if you click adult, you'll get into my section with all my stuff.
Yeah, that's excellent. So in the last note, if family members are listening, or maybe themselves are going, maybe this is part of what's been happening for me. Some people are going to be able to say clearly back to childhood. Some people might become first-time parents and their kid picks up a flu at preschool and they're now feeling catapulted into this world of distress and fear. What would you say for family members in terms of good strategies for supporting their loved one that may or may not be ready? I realize these can be a lot of different variables that make a difference here, but may or may not be ready for treatment. How can they be loving and supporting and not dismissive or invalidating of their emetophobic loved one's experience?
Yeah, that's it. I'm sure is really, really difficult. My mother was lucky I hid it all from her, but most kids don't. I think that you want to be supportive. You want to give love and care and listening and compassion to your child or whoever your loved one is. However, you don't want to be an enabler. And often those lines get blurred. So if your teenage daughter tells you, you have to empty the dishwasher like this and you have to wash your hands first, and you have to pick up everything with a towel, and don't do that. If that's what you normally use, you can say to her, I love you. I care. I can get you some help. We can talk about that. But I'm not going to put gloves on to empty my dishwasher every day. And I'm not going to wash my hands 100 times like you do. And they will freak out and get angry and say you're the worst parent ever and slam doors and whatnot. But if you start enabling that person, it just goes nowhere good, you know? It just escalates and their phobia just continues and even gets worse.
Yeah, an example of this that we've had, and I believe we shared here on the podcast, and my husband's been on a couple of times, so I think we've talked a little bit too about the dynamic within our family. But my mother-in-law is very afraid of getting vertigo. She had an experience of vertigo. It was very unpleasant. So anything that might even possibly could trigger vertigo is terrifying. And so she did not like fans being on because fans spin. And she felt like if I see the spinning, that could trigger a vertigo episode. And so we were sitting at a family get together and really in understanding this better, what does this look like in practice, family? This would look like sitting in a room and it's hot because there's lots of family gathering, a lot of people in there. And so somebody turns on the fan and she says, no, we can't. And everybody would usually kind of just muscle through and be a little sweaty and be like, so that she would be more at ease. And it's not that we don't want her to be at ease. So I'll be clear on that.
Right.
You know, we want to be loving to her. But emetophobia is hijacking and interceding that love by saying, if the fan's on, it's over.
Right.
And so a simple request, Nicole, switch seats with me. They have that fan on. I can't, I can't look at the fan. My response then is, I'm sorry, I can't move. I can't control her. I'm not going to pin her down and make sure she sits there.
Right.
But also, I don't have to get up and purposely move my spot to protect the idea that she isn't going to be able to sit there with the fans on. Now, she still moved, but she just didn't move to my seat. And you might go, why? Why do that? That's just going to piss them off or that might get them upset. And this is one of those areas where I think the other maybe advice that I would give to family members listening is being aware of your own anxiety and your own anxiety response. Like, I don't want to piss her off and I don't want to be the daughter-in-law at the event that is creating waves here. But I also don't want to feed emetophobia. And so because I love her, I'm not going to move. And she might be mad. She may miss the principle of it altogether and be like, that was weird that Nicole wouldn't move. But it's part of my explaining. And I don't do it without having any explanation at all.
Right.
Just being rude or whatever.
Yeah.
But explaining to the family, too. You know, I'm realizing when we move or when we do just suck it up and deal with the heat, even though everyone's uncomfortable.
Right.
Yeah. Is that I'm worried about making her anxious. And I can, and I'm not dealing with, it's kind of that parallel process. I'm not dealing with my own anxiety about making her anxious. So I do it. And then it doesn't solve anything. It only makes it stronger next time that she has to move and can't face the fan or else. And so part of it is about having some of those honest conversations. We're not always going to do it perfectly, whether we're talking OCD more broadly or emetophobia or any of it. But being able to go, okay, I'm going to choose to treat this as anybody else that didn't have emetophobia in this room or didn't have OCD in this room. Because now I'm taking that on for me, and I don't have emetophobia, but I'm taking that on too, right? And so, and that's what we do too in the OCD community. It's so easy to fall prey to that. And so recognizing even for ourselves, you know, I'm feeling anxious about them getting anxious. I'm trying to help them. And so realizing whether it's me needing my own support to deal with the anxiety I have around their anxiety, or maybe that this is kind of how our family system has adapted and grown over time, to be aware of that and realize that you too can handle the anxiety. It's not going to feel great if your kid is saying, Mom, I hate you. Or
I mean, one of the first things, principles that I learned in family systems theory is whose problem is this? Right? Whose problem is it? Because it's only when the person with the problem experiences the problem that they are going to get help for the problem.
Yeah.
If they don't experience their own problem, they don't have a problem, right?
They don't have a problem. You know, everybody else does.
Everybody else is hot and they're playing musical chairs,
right?
You know, but
exactly.
It seems cruel. And some people listening may think that's cruel. But, you know, the cruelest thing I believe that you can do is to shield someone from the natural consequences of their behavior, because then they stay stuck. in whatever they're in, whether it's a metaphobia or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you shield people from what would be a natural consequence, like you go to a family gathering, there's a lot of people, it's going to be a fan on, you know? A natural consequence of that is you're going to either have to look at the fan, figure out how not to look at the fan, or figure out how to get over your metaphobia, so that you can go to these things and everyone can be comfortable. I'm really apologize to Nicole's mother-in-law. We're using this example.
She's open about it, or I would.
Okay, but still, it's just a nice, neat, small example of sometimes you have to feel a little more anxious. You have to get a little bit worse so that you're more likely to seek help and get better altogether.
Yeah, and it's a challenge, but you can see how small folks' worlds can shrink.
Right.
And like you were saying, your diet had two things on it. Right. 85 pounds soaking wet. Like it becomes really small. It can become these bigger health concerns. And so really now you're able to engage in life, not from the limits and the rules that emetophobia sets, but from the values that you have. And it doesn't mean our brains won't brain. So a metaphobia, a trigger, a fear can show up every now and then. Some can be louder, some can be less loud, but learning those tools, learning, it's kind of like riding a bike, right? You learn how to ride it, and then you don't have to think through the mechanics once you get some good practice in. You're not forgetting how, but it is a lifestyle of every time I ride a bike, it's going to take this. It's going to take this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Anna, this has been fantastic. I want everybody to be aware. And again, over on this episode's blog, I'm going to have all the links and resources that Anna has out there and available. But she also has her own podcast and talks about emetophobia, shares people's stories. They come on and explain what their journeys have been like. And I think it's really powerful in helping everyone know, especially with only 85 published stories out there, that they're not alone. Yes, absolutely. So thank you for everything you do. Thank you for coming and hanging out with the fam. And
great.
Yes, I'll look forward to that self-help book in a couple years.
All right, thanks, Nicole.
Intrusive thoughts. All right, family. How fantastic was that? We've covered emet a few different times on the show, and I really value learning more about the function, the treatment, and resources available for emetophobia warriors. So another huge thanks to our guest, Anna Christie, who not only took time out of her very, very busy schedule to hang with the fam, but she has and continues to provide so many resources for practitioners and the lived experience community. And her generosity and open source sharing of so many resources has had such a profound impact in the field. So thanks again, Anna. It was a pleasure to have this conversation with you, and I look forward to integrating more of your resources into treatment. Also, another thank you to my mother-in-law, who has shared so much of herself with this community in the past on the topics of emetophobia and OCD more broadly. Love you, Mom, and I'm grateful for your vulnerability and continued willingness to share, that it might bring hope to others. And with that, we are in our intrusive thought segment, which for newer fam joining is the application segment of my show. It is that time where we try to distill some concrete takeaways from what we discussed that can be put into practice today. And I want to take it back to the question and or example of this. Is there something that you're not doing that you would do otherwise because of blank? Now, because this episode is an emet episode, a great choice to fill in that blank would be emetophobia. But for family listening, going, that's not my issue, but maybe anxiety is, like maybe my anxiety that not cleaning a certain way or going to someone's house for the holidays may trigger my loved one so much that I just agree to do it their way and to stay home or not go out at all. So I want you to think about this. If your loved one didn't have emetophobia, how would you respond? If you didn't have anxiety about their reaction, how would you respond? Maybe even sub, if this were my coworker making the request and not my spouse or my daughter or my bestie, would you react in the same way or would you handle the situation differently? Fam, there are no wrong answers to these questions. And there's no need for shame or blame to enter the chat either, because I know they try. This is merely an exercise to illuminate whether this is a dynamic that has sneaked its way into your relationships. Because get this, fam, if it has, I just want you to know it can get better. There is help and there is hope. Knowing is half the battle. But family, something I can guarantee is that you're not alone. So let's all practice illuminating, seeing if there's something that, you know what, I would respond differently. Let's notice and let's remember that we're better together.
Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family
like talking about a Met with Anna, Christy, Ben.
That's right. I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, are your clients struggling with disgust-based contamination OCD? Have you tried upgrading your ERP with the Mastery approach? Visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses and click on my link because I've got just the training for you. At OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses, you can check out OCD Training School's entire catalog of courses, including Rich Gallagher's course, Treating Contamination OCD. Where else can you build mastery over disgust-based triggers while supporting the fam at no extra cost to you? It's a win-win at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.